I don't even know what that is.
I ain't even gonna say.
You know what that is? I'll tell you what that is. That's an alien, bruv. Believe it. Going home, locking my door, and playing FIFA.
Oh, I can see its eyes.
Not sure them things is eyes.
Alright.
Okay.
Here we go, baby. Another show. Actually, not just another show. Season 5, episode 10 of your favorite paranormal film and television review podcast. Actually, most likely the only one, certainly the only one hosted by two professionals in the biz of its kind, rated P for paranormal. I'm Maddie Blake from somewhere in Rhode Island, coastal Rhode Island. And next to me, via the magic of the internet, is Tony Arkin in Brooklyn. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Maddie.
Before we begin, and we have a packed show, so I'm not going to do my normal little, you know, fiddle faddling. We're going to get right into this. We've got a great movie to get into, Attack the Block 2011. We got a new voicemail that I love. I want to talk about that. After we do the movie, we're going to do some messages we got from fans. So if you've reached out to us recently, I've been kind of collecting our favorites or the best ones, and I'm going to read some of those. So hold on if you send us a message and haven't heard yourself. Today might be the day. And then we're going to do our top three. And our top three tonight, Tony, is what?
Our top three is going to be top three armoring up, gearing up moments.
Yes. Top three arming oneself in film history. This is going to be good.
That was a good call.
Yeah, you know, the classic montage of when somebody's, you know, getting their guns ready or their arrows or whatever it may be, might be a surprise. Actually, my list has a kind of an odd weapon in it. I'm sure yours, you always come up with something weird.
Thanks. I hope I will please you.
You always do. How's everything? First of all, I watched your short.
Thanks.
Oh, well, thank you. I was totally willing and wanted to go pay for it somewhere to support the cause. But I guess I am kind of, you know, special like that.
You need the industry link. Let's face it.
I mean, let's face it. Come on. We do a podcast together.
Yeah.
And I know Jacob, and I've been in one of your movies. So if I can't throw that around, what can I throw around, really?
Well, we sent you like the edited, redacted version of it, but I think you got the idea.
Of course, your short that got into Sundance with Jacob Ware and Trish.
Yeah, Sundance last year, not this current one.
I'm sorry. Yes, last year. Correct. You wouldn't understand. It's hilarious. And it's also unbelievably paranormal, which it's
truly
really a film that we would have covered. We haven't done a short yet. Maybe we should do a special like bonus episode sometime for our subscribers, people who donate to us.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
Right. We've talked about Pound Ridge. We could certainly do Pound Ridge because, we own that and we could just send them a link and they
Absolutely.
Can watch. So we will put something together. Here's our commitment. We will put something together for those of you who contribute to the show that only you can get. And we can, you know, some sort of watch party or something like that. It'll be
Or Maddie might just come by your place. And only he would come by only your place.
Well, if there's
If it's the tri-state area, if it's close enough, I guess. Could we consider it?
Look, one person's restraining order is another person's happy visit.
True. I think it's worth the risk. Let's keep that. Let's keep that as a discussion piece.
Have you seen Pound Ridge yet?
I've got a DVD player with it.
Hello,
with a movie I'd like to see.
Hello. Oh my God, that's a guy who's a podcast I listen to. Holy shit, he's like 6'3". He's scary. Okay, let's do. Yeah, so that's great. I loved it. It's super funny. It's like it's awesome. I don't want to give anything away, but I hope that does come out where people can actually rent it and see it.
I do
awesome.
Too.
Yeah,
I do
it's
too.
It's worth it.
Right now, I think it's only France, but we'll see.
Okay, I have questions about it actually that I want you to answer off the air because I don't want any spoilers. But
I'm just
questions.
In it. I don't have. I
no,
can't
but
answer any questions
you,
for you.
No, you're smart. All right, so without any further ado, why don't we get to that voicemail message that I wanted to
yeah.
play. And again, you can go to anchor.fm/ratedparanormal, and you just click on the button, leave message, or I think it just says message, and you click it, and you can leave it. It's really easy. It's that easy. And we want more. Thank you. You guys have stepped it up again. We've got a few more, but keep them coming. We love hearing from you. Some of you ask not to be played on the show, which is fine. you make movie recommendations. I'm all for that. But other ones of you don't mind being on the show. And here's one of them right here.
Hey, guys, it's Mike Robinson calling. I've got three things for your consideration. First, continue to love what you're doing. Keep killing it. And yes, I've left you a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and just became a monthly supporter as well. Number two, I recently finished Sender. Tony, thanks for making such a fun, well-made, thought-provoking movie. And of course, thank you for putting my mind in a pretzel for the last 3 days on what this was all about. Fantastic job. Maddie, what a tour de force to performance as a knuckle-dragging muscle. P.S. I have to tell you, I cheered when you died. That's how impactful your performance was. And lastly, since I'm feeling bold, since you accepted my last movie suggestion, An American Werewolf in London, I thought I'd delve into the horror comedy genre again and come up with the 1948 classic Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Super important movie to me.
You know, that message got cut off, Tony, unfortunately, but boy, thank you so much, Michael. Means the world to us. A new donator and kind words about your movie, my performance. I'm blown away.
I totally made my day. I'm completely amazed, and that's really cool. Thank you so much.
The blood, sweat, and tears I know that you put into Sender, when somebody smart like that, who's clearly intelligent and, you know, says to you a well thought out and intelligent movie. I mean, that's like, that's it, man. That's why you do it, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, sure. Honestly, I mean, anybody who comes and says, hey, I saw it, I liked it, or even I liked part of it, is a huge treat. So let alone somebody saying that, you know, good job, and that they thought it was well done. That's huge.
Well, Michael, since you're our latest donor and supporter of this podcast, you get first ballot choice, your recommendation. Let's do it. Let's do Abbott and Costello. Can we do that, Tony, next week?
I am all in. I'm 100% behind that choice. I am. Yes, that's a big yes.
I can't think of much before that that would take horror and kind of make it overtly as silly as they did. I mean, I guess there were people. Was there?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's a really good point. I didn't really research, like, you know, comedy horror before this or like that. I mean, I know that those Abbott and Costello movies are prime examples of the first, probably some of the first versions of it. But yeah,
certainly early. We could say that. They were early adopters.
Yeah, very early. I mean, I think I can't really recall something that was a hybrid like that before
that. Interesting. I remember I mentioned it, I believe, last week's podcast, Creature Double Feature, which was a New England, I think just New England, you know, Saturday morning type of, I know they existed in other areas. On the UHF dial, ours happened to be called Creature Double Feature, and it was just, you know, campy Saturday morning movies, and Abbott and Costello were kind of rotated in there. So, listen, but I haven't seen one since I was that age.
For all you kids out there, UHF, before we had anything, just to sound like the oldest guys on the podcast
so
right now.
True, my God.
The UHF used to be everything. It used to be the only gateway to anything weird, interesting, strange, or, you know, cinematically odd.
Yes.
Because, you know, it was the only place to go. We didn't we didn't have VHS tapes even. I mean, it was literally up to whatever programming locally was going to happen. And those local channels that would run horror movies Saturday mornings and after school and pretty much like on all days on the weekends, you know, I owe everything to those UHF channels. I really do.
It's so true. Like what was the other band? It was UHF. And what was the main, like the networks? God, I'm so bad.
VHS. No, it wasn't VHS. VHF?
Something VHF. Like that. Well, that was like your parents' dial. So it was like 4, 5, 7, your networks.
It was the big network shows.
Yeah.
The big
and then
network
you
channels.
Flip it over. Mm-hmm. To UHF, and it was like 38, 56, 25 where I was from.
And it was 9 and 11 here.
Oh, that's where you're right. That's where you get the 11, good weird stuff and the late night stuff. And the
Channel 13 was PBS here.
Okay, so. Oh, man, good memory. So, yeah, we'll do that. That's a great one. More messages to come via our social media accounts. All right, we're going to dive into our movie. Then we're going to hear from some more fans. We heard from Superfan Kerrig and some new voices too. And then our top three arming oneself scenes in film history. I can't wait.
You know, Tony and I love hearing from you.
Hello, Tony and Matty. This is Peter Stray here.
And it's so easy to leave us a voicemail.
I love your show so much.
All you got to do is go to our homepage, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal.
Hey, guys, I really like your podcast.
Simply click the message button.
I hope that that's a suggestion you'll consider.
And just tell us what you think.
Love what you guys are doing.
I'm doing it right now. Isn't that meta? anchor.fm/ratedparanormal.
Chapstick.
You need to get this treated before you lose too much blood.
Do it then.
I can't do it. I don't have the equipment or the skill. I've only just graduated. And I missed the class on alien bite wounds.
Stop hyping, man.
I ain't seen you around there before, you know. You lived there long?
A couple of months.
Hmm. Nice place you got.
Thanks. Thinking of moving.
Shame. Why?
I don't like the area.
Now, what do you mean you don't like the area? And what's wrong with the area?
2011's Attack the Block, Tony, follows an unlucky young woman and a gang of tough inner-city kids who make an unlikely alliance to try and defend their turf against an invasion of savage alien creatures, turning a South London apartment complex into an intergalactic war zone, bro. Do you hear me, bro? Believe me, mate. Believe me. Attack the Block, other than my horrible British accent, hybrid accent. What did
that
you
was Mary Poppins time for sure.
Ain't no more like Mary Poppins, eh?
I'm a show. No.
I got to admit, mea culpa, old man Blake, I turned on the subtitles.
You need the closed captions.
Yeah, I really did, because I just felt like I was losing so much of it. And so I, about, you know, quarter way through, not even that much, I turned it on because I was just like, I don't want to miss what they're saying. And then even with the captions, you have to infer, because they use words that we don't use here, expressions we don't use, but you get the point. And I'm sure if you're not, as we said, old men like me, you could probably get it, but I needed it. It was helpful for me.
You know, Snatch or yeah. Lock, Stock, and Three Smoking Barrels. I mean, you know the drill. It's like this is like heavy accents, heavy London accents. It's not, you know, it'd be kind of like, I guess, the equivalent of, like, you know, The Sopranos for a British audience. You know, it's like they'd probably have to stop occasionally too, but maybe not as much.
So yeah, it's like an accent. It's like a dialect, like a Boston movie would have, maybe, you know, the town or something. It's how they. So anyway, that made it kind of interesting, and trying to follow along with the dialogue and the story. But Tony, what were your kind of general thoughts on this film? Had you seen it? Did you know about it?
Yeah, I saw it when it came out. I'm a really big fan of this movie. I think it's fantastic. I think it was underseen. I think it's underdiscussed. I think it's probably has quite a cult following at this point. Joe Cornish, the writer director, although the movie wasn't a hit here, it didn't really translate to, I guess, being a hit in America or in the States. I think it's had a long life and gathered a lot of followers over the years. And he's had a great career. He's gone on to do amazing things, Joe Cornish, and had done cool stuff before this. I love this movie. I think this is the most refreshing, surprising take on what is probably the most hackneyed idea at this point that I've seen in a while. I just thought he reinvigorated the whole genre. And managed to do something for me that was really brilliant, which was tackle, you know, legitimate social concerns, right? About folks living in cities and you know, the kind of disparity and unfairness in policing and stuff like that. He managed to take that on without proselytizing about it or making a movie about that, and somehow that stuff was so well integrated into the plot and into the reality of these characters' lives that I thought it was just kind of brilliant how we managed to do both things, like, and just for me a phenomenally entertaining, smart, funny film that also left me with a lot to think about and some actual new insights. I really kind of can't say enough about it for that. Had you seen it before?
No, I hadn't. I was so kind of captivated by the Cornetto trilogy, you know, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and World Ends, like that world. I remember when I saw, you know, kind of the trailer for this, I went like, oh, at first I thought it might have been those guys doing it. It definitely has that kind of vibe to it. I thought it was maybe an Edgar Wright film. I remember
he did executive produce it, Edgar Wright.
Right, true. But I remember at the time going like, oh, it's another one of those, and then kind of like seeing that it wasn't. And for some reason, it just slipped away at that point. You know, I never went and saw it. So this was a first watch for me. And it's funny, I spent the first, like I said, 5 minutes trying to capture the dialogue, and then had to go back and put on the closed caption. The other thing that struck me was the Moses character, John Boyega. I'm going, how do I know this guy? It's driving me crazy. And then I realized first I thought it was Denzel Washington that he was reminding me of. He looks like a young Denzel Washington in so many ways. And then I was like, oh, of course, the Star Wars dude. So I was distracted for like the first 10 minutes. I got all these thoughts going, like, could you just watch the movie for a second? You know,
did you ever settle down and relax enough to actually watch the movie? Or was it all just like poking buttons and I can't hear them? And what's happening?
This movie literally made me 80 in the first minute. Like, I can't read it. I can't see it. Who's that young guy?
Oh, he's the music's guy very loud.
So it was a first viewing. So basically what happens is these aliens start to come down like almost meteorites. And one comes down right when this young gang of ruffians is about to, or they have just successfully mugged a young nurse character played by Jodie Whittaker, who plays a part of Sam. So Sam's just coming home from wherever, and she gets mugged by them. And they get interrupted by one of these meteorites, which ends up being a little alien of some kind, alien creature. And they chase it down. They bail on the robbery, and they chase this alien down because it scratches Moses' face. And it's right about then that I kind of was broken out of my old man distractions because of the way that scene was shot. When they chase the alien down into the little hut, little house, whatever it is.
It's changes, like a gardening shed or something.
Thank you. Yes. Like some sort of shed. And
well, wait, is it a shed or a hut?
No, it wasn't. Wait.
Hold on. Was there a hedge?
Well, like an adobe.
If there was a hedge, then it was a hut for sure.
No, it was a shed. I'm telling you, it was a shed. It was a one-door shed. No, so they follow this thing in, and then the camera just stays at a distance and lets the action happen. And then they come out dragging the body of this alien, and I just thought it was the most... I've never seen anything like that, I don't think. You know, like you assume... Or I did at least, like, this alien's going to come bursting out of there and they're going to run screaming or something that we've seen a million times. And it's the opposite of that. It's really quite stunning. It's a stunning scene.
It's a great scene and it's beautifully shot. You're right. And I also particularly love the shot after that as they're, you know, coming out of the shed or the hut. I can't remember if there's a plant nearby or not, or if there's, I don't know what the outside looked like exactly, but they're coming out of this thing. And it's a wide shot, and they're silhouetted, and they're carrying their trophy of this dead alien on a stick, kind of. And it looks like a Spielberg shot, except it's really, really kind of gnarly and violent.
Yeah.
They've just killed this thing. And then the camera kind of tilts up from their silhouette of this whole gang kind of like walking over the hilltop to the skyline of London again, where the fireworks are coming down and yet more of these meteors are starting to fall, which they haven't seen yet. It's a really well done sequence and beautiful shot. And you're right. They're doing something different plot wise there. And then also camera wise, they're evoking like so much in that one shot. They're evoking like Stand By Me.
Yeah. It has a lot of that. It
really reminds me of that movie.
Yes.
And that it's also got this, it's been violent enough and strange, like an odd way to start, because so right away you're a little off balance in a good way, I think. Like the first people that you meet mug a nice young lady. Yeah. And you really are kind of on her side and are appalled at this. They don't hurt her. They throw her down and they threaten her, but they actually don't, you know, they don't do anything really serious.
Right.
But they do traumatize her. And then they take off and we follow them we follow her home, but we also follow them, and we realize, oh my God, these guys are the heroes of this movie, essentially.
Yeah.
And so it puts you a little bit on edge. It's got a little bit of that Clockwork Orange thing, too, where the people we're following, we're invested in, are actually, you know, some youths who are up to kind of sometimes no good. Like, you don't really know quite how to feel about them, except you learn through the movie that they're actually good guys. It's the environment that's made them tough and have to rely on each other this way. And you learn that. But you don't know, and he makes you play catch-up, Joe Cornish, with this movie. And yeah. I love that about it. So you're kind of on uneasy footing. You've already seen a little bit more intensity than you're used to for, like, a fun action movie with kids in it.
Right.
It's a little bit more violent and intense than you thought. And then it's got a moral center that's a little bit harder to figure out than your normal movie, so...
Yeah, it is a little ambiguous. Like, you start off being like, you little punks, you're robbing this poor woman walking home alone. You know, you just want to, like, I used to work in that world. I worked with high-risk youth. That was my first job out of college.
I just want it known I never did that, and I never felt that way about these kids.
I did.
I was never a corrections officer.
Yeah, it's like, you know, oh, these kids need a good talking to, as it were. And then those onion layers start to peel, and you start to learn that it's a little, you know, as is true in life, nothing is quite black and white. And these kids have home lives. And I just kind of, part of me said, like, if you're going to go there, go there. If you're going to show, like, troubled kids in an estate in a low-income housing project, like, let's see what it would really look like. It's been my experience, at least here in America, kids who are like that. I guess it was kind of a sanitized version of a home life for a lot of them.
In every case, they're all different, but in each case, there's something up. There's no parental figures around, or they just have one mom, or they live with an uncle, or they're unsupervised in some way, or they don't have any money. There's something going on with each of these kids that make it pretty clear. And they also live, you know, attack the block, that means the apartment block, the apartment complex that they all live in. I guess a block of flats is what they're called in UK. And so the idea of a block is a known thing to them.
Mm-hmm.
That being like their turf, that's where they all live. And they kind of protect the people that live in that area. And it's a rough neighborhood. And there's both kind of good elements and bad elements in the building. So I don't know. I feel like they did a good job of presenting a situation and a landscape where these kids, you know, have a lot of obstacles that they have to overcome. And that's why I felt they made a really good point with it by the end. You feel that they had no excuse for their behavior.
I just feel I'm talking filmmaker wise. Like, I just feel like he wanted to say, like, kids who do this and come from estates, as they call them there, they're kind of driven into that world. You know, when the kid's father said, walk the dog, I'm not asking, I'm telling. I'm like, that usually is not happening. The mom saying, be back early, doesn't usually happen in these situations.
I hear you. I'm going to disagree on a movie level with you, though, because it comes to a scene later that I think says all of that better than any kind of showing us their home life could ever do. To me, they do handle that pretty well. It seems like a real variety of reasons. Sometimes it's because, you know, you need to just protect yourself from worse people in the building. Like I said, like the drug dealer who is, like, really threatening. I mean, he's a bad news guy.
Yeah.
He's the only person who has a gun and uses it. And, you know, he's crossed over to, like, kind of a really bad place.
It felt a little bit like he dipped his toe in the water and didn't quite go there. But he also was making a comedy about aliens. So it's like, how deep do you want to go into what it's like at home? Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying every one of them had to be the same, because, you know, like I said, I worked with all kinds of different situations in that world. But
yeah,
for the most part, it wasn't involved parents or concerned guardians asking when you're going to be home. That's all I'm saying.
It didn't bother me. It didn't occur to me. And it struck me really hard. There's a scene where, I don't know if you want to get into it, because it's a little bit later in the movie.
That's all right. When have we ever followed the rules?
The movie takes place in one night. It's just it's a long chase movie. It's them, you know, trying to get back to their building and then kind of escape the building and then get back in, really. It's pretty simple plot wise. But we follow different characters who are going through different kind of adventures in that apartment complex and around it in one night. The gang of kids befriend, ultimately, the woman that they mug in the beginning. They kind of get together and help each other out.
Team up.
They go through this adventure together. And they develop a respect for each other. They kind of understand each other by the end of it and accept each other. And at one point, it kind of all happens because they have to split up. And she gets on a cell phone and she's going to go back to, creep back to his apartment to get something. I forget what she has to get at his apartment.
No, at the end, like to lure the things away?
No, it's near the end, but she's there alone. She goes back to Moses's apartment in the complex.
Yeah, right.
And he's on the phone because he has to stay in another wing. And he's on the phone with her, guiding her through his apartment.
Right.
And she goes in there and they just have like a shot of her coming in the apartment and it's a mess. It's like, it's really, really rough. Dishes everywhere, you know, pizza boxes on the floor. It's a pretty rough environment and not really safe feeling for a kid. And she's like, realizes suddenly, oh, this is where Moses comes from.
Mm-hmm.
This kid that mugged me earlier, not only did I just find out he's got more to him than I thought,
mm-hmm.
he lives here. And I live in the same building, but in a nice apartment. Like, I have nice stuff. And this is a mess. And she's walking around and she's like, where are your parents? He goes, it's just my uncle and he's never around. And you're like, oh, okay. And she pieces that together. And then she's walking through and she finds a bedroom. And she's like looking at the bedroom and it's the bedroom of like a 9-year-old. There's Spider-Man blankets on the bed and toys. And it's really kind of sad, but clearly like a kid's room.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, where's your younger brother? You didn't say anything about a younger brother. He goes, I live alone. I don't have a younger brother. And she realizes I'm in his room.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so smart and so well handled.
Yes.
In such a moment of her realizing something and the audience realizing something. And he told it visually too and didn't belabor it with a lot of dialogue. I just thought that was great. Yeah. So for me, that moment did all the things that maybe you were missing from it or whatever.
Yes,
I don't
absolutely.
Know. Or if even that answers your problem with it.
It does. That character, absolutely. And that moment does. We were talking about my initial lack of sympathy for those kids, which is a nice misdirect too, because we learn to kind of bond with them and root for them,
right.
Even though they're the quote unquote bad guys in the opening scene. So we think, it's a nitpicky thing though. It's like those other kids then become less justifiably rootable for me when I know that they do have a home life like that. Like, so the Moses character becomes like, oh, shit, yeah, that's what happens to these kids. That level of neglect.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you see like the white kid talking in that accent, acting tough, and he's got a dad at home going, hey, do this. Or the mom say, be back in line. It's like, well, wait, you don't get to act like that. You know what I mean? Like there's a little bit of, that's just my own prejudices.
You're a dad and that's the problem. I'm not a dad. I don't have to worry about any of this
like
stuff.
Like someone smacked that kid. Yeah. So anyway,
I agree with that scene.
No, I agree with you. That scene is that, I guess I wanted more of that. If you're going to go there. And I loved it.
I also think that, you know, the movie, I like the fact that the movie presents our heroes as a group, as gang members. Now, it's the fact that they're young that bothers you.
They're so young.
If we were in a Western, for instance, and there were a group of rough dudes that stole money from a woman in a carriage and then didn't hurt her, but were like, sorry, we roughed you up, ma'am, and then went away, I believe we would have different feelings because of the Western setting. The fact that this feels very real and modern and current, we're like, boy, I wouldn't want to get mugged. And so you're like in this moral predicament with these kids a little bit. But I think that's what the strength of the movie is. Honestly, I just love that they don't make any easy answers for you. And by the end, through what you is revealed rather than told you, you kind of end up having allegiances with them that you didn't expect to have. But also, like, they're behaving just like any, like the Warriors or any, like, you know, gang of kids. Like that's what they do. And it was so brave of them, I thought, of Cornish, to start the movie with this nice lady getting mugged.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a brave choice.
Yeah. Cause then he's going to say, well, you're going to rooting for this gang, which is a great thing to pull off. Crazy thing to try to attempt. And then, you know, what's our complaint about these movies? We review paranormal films, films that deal in aliens and ghosts and all these things, cryptids. It's what we do. And so one of our big things that we've done here over 50 episodes in is we tend to say like, oh, just show me something new. Show me a new wrinkle on it. Show me your vision. And man, the aliens, the way they're handled in this, the everything from, you know, the blacker than black as they touch it and you see one of these bear aliens, for lack of a better term, these monster aliens, and it's like blacker than night, was so
inventive.
You can't
even see them. You can't even see them. They're so...
Yes.
Is that a dog?
No.
No, that is not a dog.
That's black. Too black to see. That's the blackest black ever, fam.
There's like this black of space, you know.
It's yes, amazing. which would explain so much about our inability to see these creatures, and it also harkens to like shadow people. People say that shadow people, when they see them, are darker than the darkest part of the room. So the room is pitch black, and they can still see a blacker outline on the wall. I wonder if he was inspired by that. You know, so it mixes into that, and then the whole dragging the alien around in the beginning in the first act, the dead corpse of the alien, just dragging it around and people touching it. And we did a top three, like, why are you eating that? Or why are you? And there's one scene where a guy like, oh, it stinks. And he touches its face. And then he like sticks his fingers in his nose and sniffs. He's like, why are you doing that? Even if you think it was like a rubber alien, and they even if you think that, why would you touch the goo?
London's a tough place, man. They're tough.
Just so inventive, so fun. Yeah, it was really, really original take on the alien invasion. That would be my, you know, Maddie movie critic byline. A completely inventive take on the alien invasion film. And setting, character, the use of the aliens, the design of the aliens, how they defeat the alien, who defeats the alien, who teams up. I mean, really, just
and also a unique setting and group of characters to confront the situation. It's
yes.
Just so it's not something we see, and I was really surprised this movie didn't do better business here. I'm really surprised, because I that's the kind of thing that makes me go, it's like, what do you got to do to get attention like this?
Yeah.
This is Joe Cornish's first directorial effort. He had never directed a movie before this.
That's crazy, because it looks like anything is good in the Cornetto trilogy. It really does.
I know. It actually looks better than some of them, I think, to be honest.
Well,
I think it looks better than At the World's End. I do. I just
love
think
World's
it,
End.
I do too, but I think I just happen to think this movie has a look that is really, really cool. You know, Edgar Wright, I think he was a creative executive producer. I don't think he just was like, hey, I'll put my name on it. I mean, him and Joe Cornish know each other. And apparently Edgar Wright was like, when Joe Cornish brought him the script, Edgar Wright was like, well, it's a great script, but you could not have picked a harder, you couldn't have made it harder for yourself. Like,
right.
This is the hardest for a budget movie, for a not expensive movie. I mean, ordinarily, they would throw $60 million minimum at this kind of a film. I think their budget was like $6 to $8 million. I don't think they had a lot of money.
It's so brilliant to then thereby set it where they set it, because then you can see how they did it. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, yes, the big, you know, the big showdown takes place basically in that building. So you're just going from room to room. And yes, there's exterior scenes and things like that, but you can see, like, you know, you said, you and Michael, about your film Sender, when I had you guys on as my guests, you know, we knew we had this location, so we kind of rode around the location, and I think they did that, and it works. They pulled it off, though.
Well, you know, whatever, and they combined that with studio work of some of the apartments, and I mean, just as a job of production design and production management, to look at a movie that has all these exteriors, all these characters in all different parts of this, you know, this block of flats, in and out, on the outside of the building, all over the place. You're never lost. You're never confused. You always seem to be able to track where everybody is and what's going on. That's a skill that I honestly think directors are born having.
Yeah.
Or they assemble a team that can do it. But this is too complicated for Joe Cornish not to really just have a remarkable ability. That's reminds me of Spielberg's. It's not just an action movie. There's a real style to it. He's not just shooting everything with like a random handheld camera. The shots are thoughtful. They're set up shots. A lot of in-camera effects. I mean, these creatures, as beautiful as the design are, they also were on the set. These things were animatronic, you know?
Crazy.
They were puppets and stuff that the actors could actually react to.
Crazy.
And they said that they were really intimidating on the set.
Yeah.
They were really scary.
The cool technique they used with the teeth, like those kind of neon glowing teeth.
It's amazing.
So cool.
And when the light, when they die and the light goes out of their teeth,
my
and it
God.
Dims, such a great idea.
I just want to talk about John Boyega for a second.
The giant movie star that is John Boyega?
Yes.
Who I can't get enough of this guy.
Who was what at the time? I mean,
15? 16?
Like,
never been in a movie before.
You know, we talk about Cornish's ability to kind of do what he did, and all the credit in the world to him, no doubt. But yet, Boyega is called upon to be this intimidating leader presence, this badass, if you will, who with a look can lead that group and scare you at the same time, but then have this vulnerability so that we don't hate him, so that we're going to end up rooting for him, because we are. And he does it all with a look. And what Cornish does really intelligently as a filmmaker is, like, John Boyega's done, you know, he's got the hat on and the hoodie, and he gives that menacing look. He's staring, but then he'll leave the camera on him for just a little longer. Mm-hmm. And you see that badass look morph into help me, you know, I don't want to be doing this. Or
He's never not also that terrified 15-year-old kid who
exactly.
just needs someone
there's
to help him.
There's like this, I sound like a cliche, like acting coach, but there's like a vulnerability right next to the armor he's put on, he's been forced to put on, like we all do to live our lives out in the wild cities. You know, we all put on this kind of armor, but we're all vulnerable. And he shows that so well. I don't know with, you know, there's only a handful of guys, I think, that could have pulled it off at that age.
I am such a fan of John Boyega's. I can't even tell you. I think this guy it has it in him to be one of the great movie stars.
Great.
I really do. And I hope that his career takes him down the right path. He's in a new movie now I want to see. It looks like he's trying to branch out and do stuff. And after Star Wars, which has got to be hard, you know, to figure out what your career is like after playing that part. But he, like I said about Cornish, you're born with something. This guy has it. He has it in a way that you can't teach. You can't pretend to do it. He can hold the camera and make you know what he's going through and make you care about him with hardly any dialogue in a way that, like, is just the biggest, greatest movie stars can do. I think he's fantastic. Did you ever see Detroit, a movie called Detroit?
No.
Catherine Bigelow movie. Not a movie I thought was successful, except for Boyega, who is in it as a cop. And he plays this guy. The minute he shows up in the movie, it's just like, oh, we're in good hands now. We're fine.
Yeah.
He's great.
I can't wait to see what he does next. I'm hoping for maybe an End of Days remake.
I think, you know, Pound Ridge. I think there's a part.
God, would he be great in Pound Ridge. So I just, you know, he blew me away. And
great cast, though, too. I think wonderful. Like, he's not alone there. There's wonderful work around him. The kids are all authentic feeling to me and
they
funny.
Are.
And they have their own unique personalities. And they're all... They all, in one way or another, manage to capture both that menacing and lovable thing that, you know, they need.
Pest. I like that name. One of the characters' names is Pest, isn't
Pest.
He?
Pest. Yeah. Love that. I love, you know, Nick Frost. I always like seeing Nick Frost.
Yeah. And he can do no wrong, it seems.
As the weed-growing neighbor who harbors them for a while.
Do you know what else I loved about this that comes to mind? I wrote this in my notes. Was it's the ant. Ty Dubois, how fast the kids accept that this thing's an alien.
Mm-hmm.
I just love that. It's so refreshing. And, you know, it would be kids. It would be like street smart kids who wouldn't be so egotistical to have to try to say, like, well, it couldn't be aliens. Don't be ridiculous. We're adults here.
Right.
You know, it's like, yeah, man, that was probably a f-ing alien. Yeah. That was,
they're coming.
And they just buy in right away. Like, well, let's kill these things. If they're here, I just love that. It's like the anti-Dubois.
And connected to the theme, they're not prejudiced about that idea. So they're like,
right,
of course it's aliens.
Yeah.
They don't have all this programming of like, no, it can't be like you say. It's
and everyone smart. In the movie is kind of like that, like except for maybe the drug dealer. But like who? That's actually an interesting point because the drug dealer is so damaged.
He refuses to believe it.
Right, right. And
even when he believes it, he doesn't believe it anymore.
Right, because it's all about him and his ego and his worldview. And I don't give a fuck what it is. It's like maybe he's saying something about people who are denying this right now in the world.
Yeah. He's also the only capitalist in the movie who says, this is my block. This is
right.
mine.
Everyone else is, it's us.
Yeah. Everybody else says it's ours.
Great point. The Nick Frost character is equally like, and he's a little older than them, a little wiser, maybe, quote unquote, but he's just like, yeah, here's the thing about aliens. Like nobody spends time fighting
saying,
the alien.
True.
Yeah,
it's true.
Love that
it's,
about
it's
the movie.
Really, it's really great.
Yeah, we don't need those wasted scenes.
Yeah. Which I think, you know, by not having the movie take place around any scientists, that's part of what helps it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because when you avoid that whole trope, then it's just regular folks. And all of us know, like, if we saw an alien come down, we'd be like, that's an alien. It's here. It's happening. We wouldn't be like, no, it's got to be something
else. Yeah, I'm like, oh, time is here. And it's refreshing to have characters. It's like bad improv in those movies where people say things and they just keep denying them. Like, it's a relief for me to have a character say something and someone go like, yeah, no, that could be aliens. And it's like, oh, it's just, we just get right to the action that way. And it speaks to like an openness to possibility. And I just, it's fun to watch.
It is. I get you. You know, I mean, here we diverge a little bit on the Dubois concept, I think, in that.
We do.
I get, but I think I can explain it well now because I've thought about it for a year and a half.
As I've drilled it into you.
Is that sometimes I think a movie is really about what it's like to confront the supernatural in real time for someone, which is often described as a process of breaking you down, of kind of a painful breakdown of your worldview. And if the story is about that, then I want to, then the Dubois doesn't bother me because it's about what it's like to have your belief system changed. So you need some resistance to that in order to tell that story. But this is a classic example of like taking that idea and just making an action movie out of this. Like, let's get to it. Mm. And you're right. In a movie like this, to me, it would completely be pointless to have 2 minutes of time wasted on that.
It completely vibes. Yes. That vibes with the spirit of the movie.
Totally.
That's how I'd best say it. Yeah. Yes. And I agree with you when it's about that. A lot of times I feel like it's about the screenwriter thinking that there has to be an obligatory scene of someone fighting against it, but be that as it may, I hear you. Oh, we gotta have the scene now where the person says, what are you, crazy? So I love that.
Do you have other scenes or moments or lines of dialogue that really hit you, the ones that you could understand?
I wonder if that hurt the movie with American audiences, maybe not really quite understanding it.
We're not particularly cool with,
we're not patient about that.
We're not patient about other languages or dialects here, which is a shame, you know, whatever.
Okay, here's something I was concerned about. When something is set up like this, like, okay, we're in an alien fight here. And then what is set up is they are clearly after Moses, our lead, John Boyega's character. They are clearly after Moses. I start thinking ahead and I start going, how are they going to pay this off? And what are they going to do to win or lose? You know, it's a tough thing to pay off in a final act. And damn it, he did it. And, and because I believed why they were after him, I thought it was going to be something either not explained or nebulous or maybe over saccharine. I didn't know where they were going to go with it. And the way they break it down, it's kind of biological. It makes a lot of sense. He is also culpable in the decision to go kill it because he says, I'm going to kill that thing. He didn't have to do that. You know, so he's paying for his own decision, which is puts him, you know, everything paid off. I was like, yes, yes, yes. And the way they figured it out was fun and believable. Yeah, it just all paid off.
I love the thing about this movie, too, that they chose, Joe Cornish chose, not to have this be a world event.
Yes.
Or if it is, we'd have no idea. We only know what's happening on this block. And what I thought was really cool about it, I prefer to think that this wasn't happening anywhere else. Prefer to think that this is an isolated event, which actually makes it creepier. Because, look, world invasions, we've seen that 1,000 times, and it's like game over. Like, if they're going to come and invade, like, we're screwed. But the idea that occasionally spores just come down over a certain town and wreak havoc for a while and then it's over is a great device and so much more entertaining to me than like endgame stuff.
And so much more in line with the reality of what happens. We have a Tic Tac sighting. We have a Roswell. We have a Rendlesham. We don't have, you know, mass craft showing up in one day. It might happen, sure, but that's guessing. Well, yeah, that's us guessing. But if we're going to deal in reality here, it's more likely that it would be an isolated event, maybe with a one crash, right?
Yeah.
So I love that too. Yeah, everything. Yeah. And the way they paid it off is believable. It's not outlandish. If it were going to happen, you could see it happening like that. Like all those things. Like,
it also has in its DNA stuff that we both like. I mean, you know, this movie was really inspired by Signs. Cornish saw Signs and said, what would Signs be like if it was in an apartment building? Like, that's really cool. It also has a, it's built around an idea that I love. I love movies that take place in one night. I think it's a really cool structure for a movie.
So fun.
And there are a lot of really cool movies like that, like American Graffiti takes place in one evening. And I have a list here. What
also about a group of friends, teenagers. Yeah.
Halloween as a one-nighter. The Assault on Precinct 13, John Carpenter's Assault.
Yeah.
Who and also Snake Plissken, you know, Escape from New York is one night.
Yeah, he's got 24 hours.
He's the king of one. He's the king of one night movies.
That was my nickname in college, by the way. The king of one night.
Don't do that to yourself. What about lines of dialogue? I thought there were a few great ones.
Gosh, yeah, the ones I could understand.
My favorite is when he first brings the dead alien back to the drug dealer's apartment.
Yes.
And the assistant drug dealer says, "Ooh, a puppet."
Yeah, yeah. They think it's like a. Yeah.
They think it's a puppet,
a prop or something. Yeah,
which so it good. Was.
Yes,
which I think is really funny.
Super smart.
And then when the two little kids are trying to save the bigger kid from the garbage bin.
Yes.
And the one called Mayhem, a little one named Mayhem. Is like, "I'm afraid. I don't think we should be here anymore." And the other one turns to him and goes, "You can't act like that and expect to be called Mayhem."
It's such a great line. And you just reminded me of one of my favorite lines. Scene before that, Mayhem's been in the dumpster for a long time. And he's had communications with people on and off as he's getting rammed. The outside of it's getting rammed by the alien. And somebody just goes like, "Why isn't anyone coming to rescue me?" And you're like, as the viewer, you're kind of like, "Yeah, the poor kid." So it's like he's talking to us. It's so great. I know.
Yeah, there's so many. There's a lot of pleasures in this movie. And having now seeing it twice, I can kind of guarantee there's a fun second watch in it. Because
yeah.
There's a lot to get used to.
Mm-hmm.
You're resetting yourself a lot for this movie. Yeah. And so once you kind of know what it is and know that it's referencing movies like The Warriors and, you know, these other films, you can swallow it a little bit easier and know when to laugh, know when it's supposed to be funny and not. And because it's different that way.
There's a violent attack where they lose someone for the first time in the apartment building room in one of the apartments. And you mentioned Signs. It's the first thing I thought of because they look out the window. I don't remember if someone draws the blinds or not, but suffice it to say, they all look at the window and they stand. And then I believe it's Moses when he backs up. Someone backs up from the window and it's completely Signs when Mel Gibson looks out the window to see if they've arrived yet. And he just backs up. And in that long shot from the hallway of Mel Gibson backing up, and it's like, you know what he saw ain't good. Mm-hmm.
And
that they do that here and it pays off. They actually show what they see and it pays off. It looks great. Yeah. Just fantastic. I think any last thoughts, Tony, as we get into our top three and some viewer mail?
Only that there was an interesting thing I read that Joe Cornish actually got the idea for this movie. It was Signs, for sure.
Love it.
But it really wasn't until he actually got mugged in South London by a group of kids exactly like this.
Oh my God.
And he said, "I got mugged," and he said, while it was happening, they didn't hurt me, he said, and I saw they were kids. Like, in the middle of it, I realized this is like a 14, 15-year-old kid, and he saw that they were terrified.
Yeah.
That they were more scared than he was.
Yeah.
And it kind of broke his heart, and it kind of affected him, and he just couldn't stop thinking about it. And that's where the genesis comes from.
Makes me like it more. All right, Tony. Again, I don't think we did a great job of bearing the lead here, but 2011's Attack the Block. Is it getting a P for paranormal or a P for pass? No thanks.
This is the kind of movie that we built the shelf to have on it, as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, it's getting a P for paranormal for me.
Testify, brother. Amen. Agreed. P for paranormal going on our shelf. And by the way, Attack the Block 2 is in pre-production. So maybe a year from
no
now,
kidding.
I hope or so, we can go see that together. And
that is great news, because I didn't know that this movie did enough business to get a a sequel. But I guess, it stuck around long enough. Thanks to people maybe like us talking about it.
Yes.
Hopefully more people get to see it.
Absolutely. I was just glad it wasn't a J-Lo movie. Let's watch Attack
the
Block.
I was a little sad it wasn't a J-Lo movie, but comedy, stand-up, dance, Brooklyn movie.
Totally. I'm surprised she has a movie called Attack the Block with J-Lo.
Yeah. Cornish had to pay her a lot of money to get that name.
Let's hear from some P4 peers, Tony, and then we'll get into our top three. The top three arming oneself scenes of all time in movie history. Tony, we heard from Anna Billett. She said, I'm painfully late in wishing you a happy 50th episode. Well, I'm painfully late in reading this, Anna. Keep doing what you're doing. I'm finally caught up on all episodes and was inspired to send you some gems from the 90s to consider. For a different take on possession, grab a beer and pull up a chair in the saloon for 1999's Stigmata. And for all things walkin' and wonderful, is 1995's The Prophecy a good movie or a bad movie that happened to a myriad of good actors? I love how you put that.
That's great.
Love your show, my ghoulish brothers, and I hope this finds you both well. Anna, it does, because of messages like that. So thank
Indeed.
You. And those are officially going on the list, Tony.
Those are great choices. Yeah, legitimately great choices.
We heard from friend of show Kip. Guys, Yellow Jackets on Showtime will blow your minds. Haven't seen it. It's about the fifth person that's recommended it to me. I don't know if you've seen a pilot.
Not yet.
Okay, maybe we have to put that on the list too. Superfan Kerrig, he watched Wendigo. He said, well, the three of us, a 21-year-old and two 53-year-olds, decided we didn't like it. However, it would get a rated P for paranormal in our book, because it dealt with the spiritual ghost realm of the supernatural. We felt like we laughed more than we were actually scared. Would that have been the case in 2001? Maybe. But the effects seemed too cheesy today. And outside some of the props, pager, flip, cell phone, and cars, it looked like it could have been a 70s movie. So that was interesting. They kind of laughed at it, but yet felt that the paranormal bona fides were enough.
Yeah, I can understand that. And, it does feel like a 70s movie, and that was definitely clear. Yeah, look, the effects in that thing aren't why you go to see it. There's some stuff doesn't hold up that way.
Right.
Yeah, I'll agree on that.
Yeah, if you want to listen to that, last week's episode is a good one. Kind of a lost gem, maybe, Wendigo. Definitely, as we said, there's a man in a suit, and some of the effects don't last, but the
story... That's not why you watch Wendigo, really, no.
That's right. So check that out. And now let's check out our top three list. Top three, arming oneself in film history. Tony, you want to begin or you want me to begin? What do you think?
Well, I'm just going to begin by setting the table, so to speak, and say that, we always like to make it an honorary award, so I don't want to give this movie an award because it kind of is the award, so we're going to call it the Evil Dead 2 Honorary Arming Yourself Award.
It's the GOAT.
That's pretty much the GOAT. I think we can kind of agree on that, but
yes,
there's some wonderful other options here.
Yes, and this is inspired, I should say, by this week's film, Attack the Block. The kids, when they decide to go fight the aliens, they each grab their own weapons. There's a samurai sword grabbed off a wall. There's a baseball bat.
There's M80s and rockets. And...
fantastic scene.
Yeah.
So that's inspired us to think of all the great times where someone has had to arm themselves.
Now, there's the classic montage version of this, which you referenced, which is a classic. A lot of movies have it. They're all kind of referencing Evil Dead 2, Dawn of the Dead, those films, where that's a big part of the film. And then they make these montages about it. I kind of stuck to a little bit more scenes about that rather than montages about which weapons and stuff, because I thought you might maybe take that more, but
some of that.
My number three, I'm gonna make my number three an honorary mention. So should I put that last or
an honorable mention? Do you have three though?
Yeah, I have more than three. I have 1,700 of them.
Do your top three and then put that one in the honorable mentions. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to say that my number three would be from the movie Dragon Slayer. There's a really great movie. I love this film, Dragon Slayer, from the 80s, going back a ways. Maybe underseen, I don't know. But it was a beautifully done fantasy film where Peter McNichol has to get ready to fight this dragon. And they make him a spear and they give him a shield made out of scales from the dragon, and just him preparing to go do battle with this thing, always remembered it, always thought it was fantastic.
That is a blind spot for me. I will have to check that out. That's a good one. Number three is a bit of a surprise. I wanted to start small, but it's one of the iconic, to me in my mind, arming oneself scene ever, because it kind of plays against the type of what you're arming yourself with. Not bullets, not guns, not knives. This is Sean Penn in Bad Boys when he fills his pillowcase with RC Cola cans to attack the guy he's fighting with. And I just remember seeing that when I was about 15 and going like, oh, man, that scene of him loading those things. And you're thinking to yourself, what's he doing? Why is he filling his pillowcase with Coke cans?
I remember that, yeah. You were in juvie, weren't you? You were in juvie.
Oh, wait. Yeah, that actually happened to me. Never mind. Tony, you're number two.
Okay, my number two is going to be, this is in reverse in this scene, so it's actually not an arming yourself, it's a disarming yourself moment.
Love it.
Which is funnier than most arming yourself moments to me. Comes from Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, which is not a movie I really think holds up well, except for the one fight scene in the middle and the opening of it. But in the opening, Mad Max is kind of captured and dragged back to this this compound called Thunderdome, with this town.
Fantastic pick.
They bring him up to the desk where he has to get checked into the prison, basically. And they're like, all right, give us all your guns and your weapons.
Yes.
And for 5 minutes.
Just never stops.
He is pulling out sawed-off shotguns and rifles and knives and everything you could possibly imagine is tucked into his leather vests and stuff. It goes on so much longer than you think it could be funny. Amazing. And then it keeps going and it gets funnier. So I love that one.
My number two comes from Rambo, First Blood Part 2. Sly Stallone is gearing up for an interminable amount of time as Martin Cove from The Karate Kid, Cobra Kai leader, is firing up the chopper. And there's actually a great soundtrack. It sounds like a rattlesnake almost. And Stallone is like just loading up gear after gear after gear. And then it's intercut with like them getting the chopper fired up. Napier is like in the command center getting things ready. Richard Crenna is getting things ready. And Stallone's getting his guns ready. And also just shoots the shot of Stallone loading film into a camera. He's supposed to take pictures of the POWs. Like, only take pictures. And it's like subtly mixed in with the weaponry. And every time I see it, I burst out laughing. And I really don't think they did it tongue in cheek.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Is this Tri-X 400? He's got his bifocals on. Hey, these numbers are so damn small.
You watch like a bullet get jammed into a gun, and then to watch like film get slammed into the camera right next to it. It's just one of my favorite scenes ever.
Switching now. So damn funny. Okay, amazing. Is it my turn for top, my number one choice?
You're number one.
Okay, my number one choice, I'm gonna go with Jaws. And the scene where they are loading up the boat with the tanks of air and the shark cage, and they're wheeling everything on, and Chief Brody and his wife are watching this whole thing go down from the deck, and he's got all his gear and stuff, and Quint is screaming at everybody in the background, and she's just freaking out. Like, you're actually going to go on the water with this guy. And he doesn't want to go. I think that is the most effective we're getting ready for a trip we don't want to take seen for yes. me ever. And I
Fantastic.
And Jaws to me is kind of the goat anyway. I adore that movie. It's just full of scenes that are kind of the best of their kind. And I just, that one gets me every time. It's right in the middle of the movie. It's the perfect, like, beginning of this adventure that they take out to sea. And it's unforgettable.
Great choice. My number one comes from Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Come on.
A little later in the movie.
Stop it. Stop it.
Rambo's only love interest in the history of Rambo's, unfortunately, is killed. And he takes a piece of her tattered dress
and he ties it as a headband. And in the rain, he ties it around his head. And it's a great bicep shot. And then he gets his arrow. And then he gets his knife. And he's gonna go take revenge.
You definitely need some help, sir. You've been in the basement too long.
It's so great.
This is a penalty box. You can't have two Rambo movies as in the same top three. I think this is cheating.
There's nothing better gearing up wise than those two. All right, I'll put that in honorable mention. I will take Arnold and Raw Deal. Great loading up weaponry scene.
All right.
Okay. Unbelievable.
I'm just commenting. I don't have any official feelings about it.
After he gears up, he kicks the window out of the front of the car, kicks it out, plays the Stones, I think, maybe Satisfaction, and just drives into the...
I don't remember, but thank you.
Oh, man, Rod Deal's great. Okay.
That's a paranormal experience for sure. Do you have any honorable mentions?
I have one. Okay. I would take MacGruber.
Well, I was going to say, I was expecting that as number one.
It was my number one. I thought it'd be funny, better comedic device to have two from Rambo would drive you crazy.
You did. What I love about the MacGruber choice is that it knows that this trope has been done too many times. Like, it knows this montage is not only been done, but like nobody wants to see it anymore. And then it doubles down on it even harder. Which that movie just consistently does. It just keeps wearing you down until you can't take it anymore.
Same with the sex scenes, everything, every scene, the campfire scene, like every scene, every trope in action movies, it just takes it and grinds you.
Goes over it and over it again. I love it so much.
I might watch it tonight.
Great choice.
I need a
lot. I have two honorable mentions.
Yes.
One is Fright Night. I love that because I feel actually that's probably an inspiration to Cornish here. That those kids getting ready with their crucifixes and their rockets, yes, and all the stuff, the stakes that they have, it's really funny and great. But I'm gonna go for I'm gonna shame us both and say that I'm gonna talk about, you talk about this movie a lot, you also talk about Arnold a lot, I'm gonna bring this up again. I think The Exorcist has one of the great getting ready for battle arming up scenes ever in history.
100%.
When they're quietly getting the holy water and their garb on, and they're kind of quietly going over what they have to do, boy, that is intense.
I mentioned that scene in the Exorcist episode as maybe my favorite line, I think. Favorite line or favorite scene.
You did reference it, yeah.
Yeah, not in terms of them arming up, obviously, but it was Max von Sydow's response to Jason Miller, to Damien Karras, and he says... Well, she says she's multiple personalities. He's nervous. He's over talking. And Max von Sydow goes, there's only one.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
they work in silence again. It's like, oh my God, I just get the chills thinking about it. Great
so
pick. Great pick. Great episode. Great recommendation. Great movie. Thank you for listening. And you guys are great. Thank you for the participation. Thank you for donating. I mean, above and beyond. And you know what? Promise you, we put it right back into doing this podcast. We're going to put it into merch gear. We're just saving up to go ahead and do that for you guys so we can give it back to you anyway. It keeps us going. Thank you so much. We don't do it for money, but it's also not free. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Indeed.
See you next week for an old-timey classic.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Rated P for Paranormal. Please rate, review, and share. It really does make a difference. For more information, to participate, and even donate, go to our main page, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal. On social media, we're @ratedparanormal. All music is by Andrew Galdens Jr. You can find him on Instagram @kidriga, or go to therocketscience.bandcamp.com. This podcast was created, written, produced, and edited by Maddie Blake and Anthony Arkin. Are you-
ain't no more like Mary Poppins, eh?
I'm a show.